Welcome to the Victory Show.
Welcome to the Victory Show, where seven and eight figure founders, entrepreneurs, and executives reveal the real playbook behind scaling past that first million in revenue. We go beyond the highlight reel into the hard lessons, costly mistakes, and key growth inflection points, and the human decisions that shaped the numbers. And here's the twist. Every conversation we have becomes a chapter in our Victory Book series, so the next generation of builders doesn't have to start from scratch. Today, I'm sitting down with David Coates, who has spent nearly 50 years at the heart of one of the most powerful and often misunderstood forces on Earth, nuclear power. David, known to his friends as Dave, began his journey in the U.S. Navy's nuclear propulsion program, serving aboard submarines and developing the technical and operational discipline that would shape his entire career. After more than three decades in commercial nuclear power, David retired, sort of, only to step into a new role as the COO at the Materials and Fuels Complex at Idaho National Laboratory, one of the most advanced nuclear R&D facilities in the world. There, his team designs, builds, and tests prototype nuclear fuels, performs post-irradiation examination, and even constructs radioisotope thermoelectric generators, the main source of power for NASA's deep space missions and their Mars rovers. So today we're going to talk about leadership, legacy, and the quiet excellence in a field that powers both Earth and exploration. David, thank you for being here today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
I got to say, I was excited to chat with you simply because of, I'm speaking in broad strokes, but let's say Western societies general, and that meaning primarily the United States, sort of after 30 years of trying to get away from, fossil fuels as an energy source, and we've been trying to get towards solar and wind, and then this weird new technology called AI comes on board, and now it's like 10xing, 100xing the amount of energy that some of these companies are requiring just to power the data centers. So it feels like nuclear could be a good solution to that. Let's start there, and then I'll ask you more questions about your career.
Let me see if I can comment a little bit on where things are right now. Of course, with Donald Trump becoming president, and with new leadership in the Department of Energy, there's a major government focus on reestablishing and maintaining the U.S.'s leadership in nuclear power, all different kinds of forms. One of the things that's hurt us in the past is the political sensitivity over nuclear power, particularly where we're going to put spent nuclear fuel. A lot of those issues have been solved in more of a temporary nature, but even the temporary nature we have is very safe. Most commercial plants store on property. It isn't a forever scenario to continue to do that, but it is good enough to allow us to continue building large base load commercial plants. But ultimately, the outlook for small modular reactors, something that's in the mid hundreds of megawatts in generation, and even micro reactors that can generate 5 to 10 megawatts electrical, have become more desirable for a couple of reasons. One is, the military in particular, they have a need for a power source that doesn't rely on just thousands of gallons of diesel fuel. It's difficult to transport that into remote bases or forward operating posts, that sort of thing. So there is a big push of, I'll still refer to them as Department of Defense, to develop a micro reactor that they can truck in and use as a power source. In fact, we're hosting a demonstration micro reactors called Pele. So that's one aspect that's pushing new nuclear, is needs of the Department of Defense.
So what was like a microreactor, like how, what are we talking about in terms of size, and then like sort of what could that actually power?
In terms of size, the intent is to make them mobile. Put them on a
Something you
large
could put
truck
on the back
bed.
of a truck.
Yes, exactly. 18-wheeler. Plus, they can be constructed in a factory and shipped out somewhere.
Wow.
So that's the desired end state. As far as power production, like I said, we're talking 5 to 10 megawatts electrical, which is in the range of a large diesel powered generator.
Wow.
Your typical large diesel power generator probably generates anywhere from 5 to 6.5 megawatts electrical. So that's really where a lot of the focus is right now, microreactor technology. There are other companies that have received a lot of, I'll call it seed money. Private investors invested heavily. For example, one, Oklo, they're actually building a demonstration reactor on MFC property at Idaho National Laboratory. And it's supposed to be able to generate roughly 70 megawatts electrical, probably more like in the small modular reactor frame. That is going to happen. And then there's a couple of companies that are developing microreactor technology in addition to what the DoD is doing with Pele, right here at INL. So where I'm going with this is that the political atmosphere supports new nuclear. We have an administration that has made new nuclear kind of the keystone for what they want the Department of Energy to focus on, amongst other things. And lastly, the administration is putting a high focus on restoring the infrastructure to mine the uranium, turn it into usable fuel right here in the country for what is hurting us, especially with commercial nuclear, is the dependency on Russia. And you know what the political climate is right now between U.S. and Russia and Europe and Russia. A lot of countries have terminated purchasing uranium from Russia, and they're getting it elsewhere. But for the U.S., if we're going to really expand new nuclear, we've got to mine it, refine it, enrich it right here in America.
So where did all the fear come from with nuclear? Was that just because of like Chernobyl and the Three Mile Island happening within kind of a relative space of time, and that made people think, oh, this is not safe? And even though here we are, 40 some years later, people still have the
Right.
assumption that that nuclear is dirty and dangerous.
Yeah. 3 Mile Island, which most people will remember that, especially if they're were old enough to remember things in the late 70s. 3 Mile Island, that accident, which affected Unit 2, Unit 1 operated for 40 some odd years. It closed. But again, the U.S. government is actually supporting restart of TMI Unit 1
Wow.
and another commercial plant that shut down a couple years ago, Palisades up in Michigan. But TMI Unit 2 was a brand new unit, had just started up, was in its first operating cycle. And there was an event that caused a perturbation in the plant. And at that time, the plant's response was something that operators had not been thoroughly trained on because it was never really considered. So one thing led to another. There was a core melt, but it was all contained in the reactor vessel. There was no release to the environment. No one died as a result of TMI. But all the you know how news can be, how the media can be. They really, I'll just say, kind of play to the hill. And public sentiment became very negative at that point. But what is really odd, coincidental to that, there was a Hollywood motion picture that came out at roughly the same time, right before the event. That was The China Syndrome. Mm-hmm. You remember that movie? Mm-hmm. Starred Michael Douglas, Jane Fonda, and yep. other folks. And really just kind of, it just catapulted the political climate for nuclear in the negative direction. There was a huge construction buildup in the U.S. that was underway in the 70s. In fact, the first commercial plant I worked at started out to be a four-unit plant, but all but one unit was canceled simply because of all the increased regulation that came out of the response to the Three Mile Island accident. As time went on, the Chernobyl accident, which that was a completely different design reactor. They did not have a containment building like all U.S. commercial nuclear reactors have, and there was a strong release from there that further damaged the commercial nuclear construction activity in the U.S. But things have changed over time. Public sentiment has become more positive. They're supportive of building new nuclear. I think we're right at the cusp of a real nuclear renaissance that I thought we were going to have back in the late 90s. Which didn't really happen, but I think it could possibly happen if we can continue the momentum that we have right now.
So we talk a little bit about the advancements that have taken place in nuclear power, especially just the last 30, let's say since, the late 90s, early 2000s, just in terms of safety, in terms of efficiency, and in terms of just what have been the, because again, right, we're in this era with AI, and it's just like the AI we have now is, 100 times better than the one that was just a few years ago. So it's interesting. We can look at it and technology that's happening, and people forget that that's been going on in nuclear. It's just not been getting the press that it needs. And it's, it's been happening, but just with people like you, or most of us, don't realize what's going on. So that was a long loaded answer to say, can we just talk about how has it advanced in the last 20 years or 25 years?
For large commercial, I'll call them base load reactors, we're talking something that's 1,000 megawatts electrical or even larger. Companies like Westinghouse developed probably the most desirable advanced design for a pressurized water reactor, a light water reactor. Light water reactor technology has existed since the early days of naval nuclear propulsion. It was a light water pressurized water reactor that powered the Nautilus submarine, the first nuclear powered submarine in the world. That technology just developed over a period of decades. But the thing about that kind of technology, it required a lot of active components to ensure safety. Lots of pumps and valves, very dependent on having electrical power or backup electrical power. Westinghouse's most recent design that has been constructed, the first operating, they're called AP1000s, Advanced Pressurized Water Reactor 1000 megawatts. China was actually the first to build them. They've been operating them for a while. The Vogtle nuclear power plant in Georgia, they built two early design pressurized water reactors that are still in operation. But the third and fourth units they built are AP1000 designs. The beauty of the AP1000 design is it has a lot more passive safety systems, doesn't require immediate operator intervention if there's an automatic reactor shutdown. And there's a lot of other just design features that reduce the dependency on pumps and valves and, you know, operator action to put the plant in safe condition if there's some kind of problem. And that's generally the way more modern reactors have been designed.
So in terms of, like, when you say, you know, the whatever it was, 1,000, which is 1,000 kilowatts, is that what you said? 1,000
megawatts.
Now 1,000 megawatts. Look, just in terms of, for someone like me who doesn't understand nuclear at all, like, how many houses does that power?
Oh, wow. Thousands. Just thousands, yeah.
So a city of like a million people, that might...
Yeah, a plant like the Vogtle plant in Georgia can support a large portion of the needs for the whole state.
Wow.
Yeah.
So fascinating to me that we can have one unit that can provide that much power. And in terms of like the cost,
Vogtle's actually four
units,
large nuclear units. Yeah,
but it's all in one footprint,
all in one spot. Yeah.
Yeah. So and so in terms of cost, then how does nuclear hold up against, you know, natural gas or heating oil?
That's a great question. I mentioned the first nuclear renaissance that was very promising in the late 90s. One of the key things that killed that nuclear renaissance was fracking and just developing just a glut of natural
gas.
Cheap fuel. You know, all a reactor does is it makes heat. You heat water. Depending on the type of reactor, you take that hot water that's under high pressure and you use it to boil water in another vessel that's at a lower pressure, turns to steam. Steam turns a turbine. Turbine turns a generator. You make electricity.
Wow.
That's the basic premise for anything that produces electricity that uses some kind of heat source. Of course, there's other ways. Gas-fired turbines, you know, like natural gas, just the huge glut of it at that time. Plus, what also hurt nuclear was government subsidies of quote-unquote renewables like solar, wind, which the current government's actually trying to take those away.
Right.
So from a economical competitive advantage, nuclear was lagging for a couple of reasons. One is just the huge cost of constructing the plant. The new Vogtle plants ended up being, the two units together ended up costing like $25 billion.
Wow. So $12 billion a piece.
Yeah, if not more. I don't quote my figures, but it was sure. Very high cost. And there were some other contributing factors to why it took so long to build the two units. But long story short, we now have a government that's actually supporting funding of new nuclear. The Trump administration, rather the Department of Energy and Westinghouse have partnered. That's like an $80 billion deal to build new nuclear in the U.S. I believe that for large baseload plants, the AP1000 is the way to go. However, there are other first-of-a-kind reactors that are under development, like TerraPower. They want to build like a 500-megawatt demonstration plant in Wyoming. Very, very new design. I can't speak a lot to the specifics, but it's a sodium cooled fast reactor. And is quite something that they want to build such a large plant for a demonstration plant. But that
makes sense. You know, the irony to me is that we're not building nuclear because it's too expensive. I just quickly looked up like how much money has the U.S. government spent on solar and wind in the last 20 years, and it's well over $500 billion just in the tax subsidies. That doesn't include the private money that's been spent. So you just look at that going, and what did that get us really? Like, you know, how, and compared to, you know, the efficiency, I always come down to the efficiency again, like with solar power, it's great, but it only works, you know, 8 to 12 hours a day if you have the sun.
Yeah, you need sun and wind. And there is a place for those types of power sources, hydro, there's a place for that.
Yeah.
I believe, and many others believe, that building nuclear is the way of the future. Fusion development is certainly the way of the more distant future. We're probably still decades away from developing a commercial scale fusion plant, but we're, you know, we have some momentum going on there.
So let's talk a little bit then about the primary reasons people sort of, like, you know, don't want nuclear. Obviously, could be have an accident. And then the second part is there's the waste, right? Yep. I live in Nevada, and you know, I wasn't here, but I remember when they had the Iron Mountain deal, and sounds like they found a very reasonable solution to the country, most of the country's nuclear waste, by putting it in a granite mountain. And yet people were still like, oh no, that's dangerous. And they killed the deal. So where are we at in terms of, like, what is the risk really, and how much waste is there, and what are the, you know, what are some of the, I guess, smart, safe ways that we're dealing with that now that aren't really a concern anymore, even though people think they are?
Well, it's still the political climate. Mm-hmm. That's still an area that needs to be, I don't want to use conquered, but, you know, there's a lot more public, stronger public opinion to build new nuclear, but the public sentiment for, you know, where do you put spent nuclear fuel, other radiological waste, where do you store all this?
Can't we just give it to Elon Musk and have him blast it into space?
Shoot it into space. there are multiple ways to handle it. But a lot of the current treatment methodologies for, say, liquid waste or solid radioactive waste is still involves burial. You know, we try to condense it as much as possible. For nuclear fuel, you got to go all the way back to the Jimmy Carter administration to understand that we had the capacity to recycle fuel, nuclear fuel, decades ago.
Wow.
And the Carter administration pretty much killed it. We also constructed and operated a nuclear plant at MFC. This is back in the 80s, maybe it was the 70s. It was first constructed, but it operated for several years. And it was a closed fuel cycle. It was a demonstration plant, but it demonstrated we could do that. It was called Experimental Breeder Reactor Number 2. And anyway, where I was going with this is that all of the technology to create a somewhat close cycle was there. The Clinton administration killed that demonstration reactor, closed it. So we're talking a lot about the political environment that supports recycling the nuclear fuel. A lot of the sentiment is buried unnecessarily in nuclear proliferation. You know, you start developing fuel that, you know, under the right circumstances and use the right technology, you could turn it into bomb fuel. But it's kind of a far-fetched idea that would even happen. But where I'm going with this is there is a push again to redevelop an institute recycle capability in the U.S., which we once had, and also the ability to enrich our own fuel.
It just seems bizarre to me that 50 years ago we had the ability to recycle it, and now we don't because just those programs got shut down. My brain is like, I don't get it.
Here's another thing that hurts commercial nuclear in the U.S. You look at the countries that are building a lot of new nuclear, like China. They don't have the political environment that you have to worry about in the U.S. That is probably the key thing that we need the most is the right political environment under which to redevelop the infrastructure that we need to build a lot of nuclear, a lot of which has just been lost over the years.
So what would it take then? Like, I'm just imagining, like, let's say political climate changes, we have the subsidies, we have the money. How many reactors or plants would it actually take to make the 48 United States, like, basically 100% nuclear powered for their electricity, completely off of fossil fuels and everything else?
Well, if you think about how many reactors are currently operational in the U.S., it's about 90 commercial nuclear reactors that still operate.
And I think most people would think that they would be shocked that it was that many.
There's that many, but guess how much of the lower 48's power that those 90 reactors supply. It's roughly 15%.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, the U.S. is the biggest consumer of energy.
Yeah.
In the world.
Yep.
We're the biggest consumer of everything in the world. So to go full nuclear for the U.S., it would take a major campaign, not, I'm just going to, I'm, these are Dave Coates' words. It would take a major campaign like the Manhattan Project to build all the nuclear that we would need to go 100% nuclear within the next 20 to 30 years.
No.
Yeah. But you don't need to have a Manhattan Project to make it happen. You just need to have a government that supports it.
Government supports it and have 10 to 15 years of consistent policy without it going back and forth.
Exactly. And have and you have to have investors that are willing to take the risk. That's a lot of what killed commercial in the 70s and 80s. Commercial utilities, they just lost the appetite for taking on any kind of risk associated with building new nuclear.
Yeah. Well, so it's like, because I look at Nevada, and it's, we're what? I think maybe 2.5 million people total. So you just kind of think of, like, doesn't seem like it would take that much for just our state to be fully nuclear powered. And I mean, obviously, being in Vegas, we get a lot of sun. And so they're definitely doubling down on the solar power. I mean, now if you fly into Vegas, you just see we're just like a sea of glass around the city now. But that also comes with its drawbacks, right? Last summer was like the hottest summer on record, and everybody's like, "Well, it's climate change." It's, I was like, maybe it's because we have 1,000 miles of glass around the city now that's reflecting the sun back in the air. So, yeah, it's interesting. So, what for you? Like, what are the exciting developments that are taking place in nuclear right now, outside of the political climate? Just from a technology standpoint, where do you think the next 5 to 10 years, the sort of the big opportunities lie?
Micro reactors.
Yeah.
I think TerraPower getting their demonstration reactor project actually going, constructed, and really making the progress towards commercial operation. But micro is where the short term gains will happen. Smaller reactor, the design.
So we've got the, what was it you said, 70 megawatt unit that the military is doing? Like, how much does that
Well,
power?
a micro reactor like Pele, which the DoD is behind, we're talking 5 to 10 megawatt electrical range.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
Maybe more.
clean, and you're just running it, and there's you nothing to no fuel to resource it, just all self-contained. That's amazing to me.
For larger plants, designs like the AP1000, large base load plants, still requires a lot of on-site construction, building not stuff not exactly from scratch. But one of the other intents behind the AP1000 design was to have more modular construction. You build it somewhere, you ship it in, and then you put the modules together to build your nuclear power plant. The smaller the reactor design, the more remotely it can be built and transported. However, if you want to really build something that's going to power a city, I don't think you'll see dozens of micro reactors. I
True.
think that's possible, but you'll see small modular reactor technology become more palatable. The current SMR design that's fully approved for construction by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was developed by NuScale. In fact, they were going to build a demonstration plant at INL, and the property had been set aside for them to do that. But what shut them down was just the lack of subscriptions for the power they were going to produce by different organizations, either in Utah or Idaho or elsewhere. Because to build the money, you've got to know that people are going to buy the power once you've got the plant built. But they're still shopping around trying to build their first plant. Undoubtedly, it will likely be built outside of the U.S.
Shame.
Yeah.
Well, the final state on this, because I look at this stuff, and all I hear is the news stories and the fear mongering that goes on, and a lot of it is like, oh, the nuclear power plants, they're not safe, and so it could be danger. And again, I live in Nevada, where I think 80% of the state is deserted wilderness. So I just like, you telling me like we just can't put one like 2 miles out in the desert here where there's nothing? And like that's to me just doesn't make any sense. But so with where you're at and the work you're on, like where would you like to see nuclear power in the United States? Let's just go out a decade. By the time we hit the 2030s, what's possible, and where would you like to see us get to?
Possibilities are endless. I think we both understand what the hurdles are. Most of those hurdles can be overcome. However, you need to have the consistent political support, the desirability, and ultimately we're going to have to make it palatable to at least some states, to create some kind of long-term, spent nuclear fuel repository, as well as rebuild the infrastructure needed to support all this. So if you look at in 10 years, I do believe the micro reactor technology will be in place. There's a huge push for these large data centers that need heavy electrical support, electrical power support. And there are companies out there that are already contracting with current nuclear utilities to support their power.
Well, it feels like, I know one of the big problems with data centers is the amount of heat that they put off. So it just feels like combining, the data centers with some sort of nuclear power and co-opting the heat generated from both of those seems like there would be some sort of synergy there, but.
Well, I don't know about the heat from the data centers being useful to produce power. Of course, you have to reject it And I don't know that I'm qualified to get into how we're going to handle that problem. The point I'm trying to make is that because of the push for all these huge data centers, which for all intents and purposes is to support the further development of artificial intelligence, nuclear power is what's going to be needed to support that. So if anything propels the development and implementation of new nuclear over the next 10 years, it will be that.
Doesn't feel like a reach to see some of these companies come in and build a data center cluster and then just put their own nuclear reactor sort of right in the middle of it to power their own stuff.
Very possible. Yeah. Very possible.
Well, David, this has been a fantastic conversation. This has been amazing to kind of hear what's going on and sort of see where we've been and where we're at and where we're going. So I appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Oh, enjoyed it. Thanks for the opportunity.